I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, there is nothing like your health app on your iPhone, which I know you don't have anymore, telling you that you walked 20,000 steps in one day to remind you that you went to Denver Comic Con.
Nice, 20,000. That's 10,000 too many, Patrick. You shouldn't have done that to yourself. Yeah. You're only supposed to do 10,000. That's cool. And I think we're going to get into a little bit more of your con experience because our guest today is Delilah S. Dawson. Delilah has a new book out that she co-wrote with Kevin Hearn. It is called Kill the Farm Boy, and it will be out on July 17th. Delilah, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. And my blistered feet from Denver Comic Con.
Right. So let's get to that. So, did you do 20,000 steps in a day at the con as well?
I threw away my Fitbit because it was judging me. So I have no idea. I just know that my feet hurt at the end of the day and I had to like do foot yoga and lay in bed with cramping feet, drinking magnesium. So I'm old and I walked a lot.
Now, let me ask you this. Are you generally a pretty active person to begin with? Like, are you out there walking, exercising on a regular basis?
Man, I don't run unless I'm chased or there's like a taco truck. I do not like movement very much, but I love cons. I like movement with purpose. Like, I don't want to get on a treadmill, but I love cons, like the way I feel, or walking around New York City. So yeah, like I that's my exercise. I go in like gigantic once a month bursts.
So you get all of your steps in
oh, yeah.
One day per month.
Well, four so it's days. Like 30... It's like 4 days
okay. Of con. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. So, you know, you could do, you know, 100,000 steps a day and you're good.
Yeah. That's,
so, that's great. So what are some of the panels and things like that you were involved with at that con?
Oh man, I love Denver Comic Con and I love Denver. So let's see here. I really enjoyed my Star Wars panels are always really lively because they are usually moderated by people who work for Star Wars and ask questions that make us look good and have lots to say. So I had a Star Wars books panel with Christy Golden and Mark Thompson. And then I had a Star Wars comics panel with Charles Soule and Jody Hauser and Bobby Kernow, who is an editor at IDW. And so, yeah, those were really lively. I had some really great book signings. We got to give away some arcs of Kill the Farm Boy. And I did some signings of kind of, you know, whatever anybody brought me. The 501st came up one time with a Phasma and a Hux and it's a couple stormtroopers. So I got to like try on a Phasma helmet. That was pretty awesome. And then just getting to hang out with friends is always a really big deal. We writers, we live alone far away and we only get to like hang out with our friends at these cons. So I got to be extroverted for a couple hours. It was amazing.
Were your book signings at the Tattered Cover Annex?
Yeah, luckily Del Rey was like cattywampus to catty corner, excuse me. I'm looking at some sandhill cranes and my brain isn't working because they're cute. Yeah, they're right around the corner. So I had, I think, two or three signings at Tattered Cover and then a signing at Del Rey where we gave away like 100 Kill the Farm Boys in 30 minutes.
And John, you've never been, so you don't understand the scale of the exhibit hall at Denver Comic Con. It is massive. And even if you're just in that little author's row section, and I say little, but I mean, it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
And Tattered Cover has a massive presence there.
Well, but they sold out of all of my books on Friday. So it's kind of awkward. Luckily, Del Rey, for every signing, they gave me like 20 copies of Kill the Farm Boy that I could hide under the table and give to people that walked up and be like, I tried to buy your book. And I'm like, let me give you a free one for friends now.
They also printed up a paperback Star Wars sampler that they were handing out for free.
Well, that one's cool. The Del Rey sampler has half the book is Star Wars samples, and then you flip it over and half the book is fantasy samples. So I actually have a piece in each half.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I love Del Rey.
Yeah, and you were talking about some of the folks that you were on the panel with. You mentioned Charles Soule. Like, he's writing the current Vader comic, correct?
Yep.
That is some good stuff. I haven't been keeping up with all the Star Wars comics like I was when the new canon started, but that's one that I have been trying to keep going with. And he's doing a great job with that of kind of piecing together Anakin's transition to Vader and all the stuff leading up to the original trilogy timeline. And that's some good stuff. If you're not reading those comics, I recommend them. They're definitely worth your time. And Christy Golden too, who wrote one of my favorite Star Wars books, the one with the Asajj Ventress. And I always forget the
Dark
name
Disciple.
Of it. Yes. I love that.
Man, there was a really good Quinlan Vos Asajj Ventress couple that came up there to get pictures with her. They looked amazing.
I'm going to have to go online and look at that, because that's one of my favorite Star Wars stories, is that relationship that she wrote about, which I know was based on scripts for the Clone Wars animated series. And I don't know how far that ever got in terms of, like, I don't know if they actually got to storyboarding it, and if there was, because I know basically they did sort of a second half of that sixth season that didn't get completed. But anyway.
So Delilah brought up something, John, that I just want to throw out there. The cosplay at Denver Comic Con is amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Did you see all the Mandalorians, dude? There was like three or four or five guys in Mandalorian armor running.
Yeah,
around.
So the Denver Mountain Garrison of the 501st, the Rebel Legion, and the Mandalorian Mercs are a really active, kind, busy community. They always have really great kind of like representation of groups there. And so if you're into like Star Wars cosplay, they're guys. I went to dinner with them one night, and they just are so
nice.
So nice, and their cosplay is just so on the level. They had a Captain Rex that like you could not have a better Captain Rex, and he could even do the voice.
Nice. Did you happen to see Carrie Vaughn?
No, I didn't see her, I think, the whole time I was there.
Carrie was walking around dressed as Admiral Lisa Hayes from Robotech.
Oh, that's really cool.
And it was dead on. She loves to do costumes, so I was really impressed with that.
Delilah, do you ever do the cosplay thing? Do you ever sort of dress for the con?
I mean, I did cosplay when I first started out as an author in like 2012, and my books were steampunk, and I thought maybe if I wear a steampunk outfit, people will talk to me. But I got harassed a lot.
Oh no.
And it wasn't very fun, and it didn't actually sell books. And then when I broke my back, I can't wear a corset anymore. So I haven't actually cosplayed in a long time, but I do have, like, my con wardrobe was mostly, you know, Star Wars and geek shirts with like nice jeans and cute shoes. And then I have like several Star Wars dresses. So I kind of try to do like professional geek for cons, but yeah, I don't cosplay anymore.
I walk around with a black shirt that says writer on it, and then my website.
That's got levels, man.
I try.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can get back to that a little later in the show. I want to take a minute to thank everybody who's backing the show, who's giving us, supporting it every month over on patreon.com/functionalnerds. Thank you. It helps us get cool guests like Delilah on the show. And if you're listening and you like what we're doing and you like these kinds of interviews, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can back us for $1 a month. You can back us for $5 a month, whatever works for you. It helps us out a lot. So that's that. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Delilah, do you have a pick ready?
Yes, I have two, actually. Okay. The first one is a comic. It's my favorite comic I've ever read. It is the Transformers More Than Meets the Eye and Lost Light series by James Roberts. So it's all one series. It starts with More Than Meets the Eye, number one. And then at some point, it kind of does that minor reboot where it starts being called The Lost Light, but it's still the same storyline. It is the best thing I've read in forever, and it's drawing to a close as we head toward, you know, everybody knows the Transformers, all of the comics are heading into a Unicron extinction event where they're going to reboot the Transformers comics. So there's not a lot left, but you can usually get a pretty good deal on the TPs or like the grouped Kindle books. But oh my God, like that's the one I wait until midnight and we read it and I am shook. Wow. And then my other one is The Lore Podcast by Aaron Mankey.
Oh, I love that one.
A fellow Delray author and a good friend, but I've never listened to podcasts before. I'm not a listening person. I like to read things, and I don't have anything I do with my hands. So I always feel like I'm not multitasking if I'm podcasting, but now I listen to that while I'm doing the dishes, and it's really fun, and it sparked some ideas in books I'm writing. And now he's also got a series of books with Delray. So if you're not a podcast person, but you're a more bookie person, you can get the books, or I guess Amazon has a TV show.
Yep. I've seen that. It's actually really good.
But yeah, it's like, you know, historical stories about scary stuff, delving deep. And it's like, you know, every now and then you hear a scary story and you're like, I want to know more, but I don't have enough time to do like 10 days worth of research and fall down a Wikipedia hole. And you're like, let Aaron fall down that Wikipedia hole for you. But the weird thing is, like, I was friends with him before I had ever heard the podcast. And like, I've been friends with him since like New York Comic Con. So like to listen to the podcast for the first time after 6 months of being friends with someone and hear their voice, you're like, dude, what are you doing? Why do you sound so formal? What is this? I'm Aaron Mankey, and this is Lore. Yes. Okay, bud, whatever.
I like the Amazon adaptation. I think it's still his voice.
I mean, I'm sure it is. People seem to really know it. Like, you can see people talking to him, trying to figure out who, and then they're like, oh my God, dude, that's you. I listen to you all the time.
Yeah, I've actually, believe it or not, I've had people come up at conventions and say, will you, because I forget what it was I used to say, but I used to say something on SF Signal, and people used to come up to me and say, will you say that? And I would say it, and they're like, yeah, that's it.
That's the good stuff.
That's the voice.
Cool. Yeah, that's I'm interested in both of those. Yeah, comics are such a, it's a thing where I keep wanting to get back to them more, and it's comics are, you know, you could spend your whole paycheck on comics if you want.
Oh, I used
so
to.
So it's hard to pick and yeah. And now you Delilah, you picked the Transformers one, but
yeah.
Do you in general read more than that? Do you have monthly books that you follow? Do you wait for trade paperbacks? Do you read them on an iPad or something? Like, how much and how do you go about reading your comics?
Right now, my workload is such that I don't have a ton of outside time to explore new things, unfortunately. So most of my research is either for blurbs, or most of my reading is mostly research or blurbs right now. But when I hear enough smart people that I trust talk about something, like I hit a critical mass and I have to go read it. So that, oh my God, there's a lizard in my office, y'all. Oh my God, he's looking at me. Sorry, Florida.
Is he trying to sell you insurance?
Well, no, they like to die in here. I have this corner where lizards go to die and there's like two dead bodies in here.
Oh, jeez.
So I guess I can start my collection. But yeah, no, I probably don't read it. It's like what all writers say when you get to this point of your career. Like, I don't get to read for pleasure as much as I wish I could.
Yeah, that's a tough, a good but tough spot to be in. One of the downsides of the profession, I imagine. So cool. You know, I'm not going to pick it, but there's a show on a little documentary series on Netflix called, I think it's called The Toys That Made Us.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't. There's a Transformers episode that I haven't watched yet. It's in there. Is it? I watched the ones they did. I watched the He-Man one, the G.I. Joe one, and the Star Wars one. But the Transformers one came out maybe a month ago or something. And I haven't gotten to that one yet.
It will blow your mind because, and I'm going to spoil it for you now, John.
That's okay.
I'm going to spoil it.
They're actually tiny people that have been flash frozen.
No, the if you look at it from an evolution standpoint, like if you look at the ancestors of the Transformers, the ancestors of the Transformers were Hasbro's G.I. Joe figures.
Oh,
because Hasbro was selling G.I. Joe, a toy maker in Japan wanted a new toy line. They licensed G.I. Joe to sell in Japan and then realized they can't sell American soldier dolls and toys to Japanese kids and families because it was too soon after World War II. And there was still a lot of animosity. So they had to do something with these toys to make them palatable to the Japanese families. So they made them see-through. They put glitter inside them and they called them, I think it's Mega Cyborgs.
Wow.
And as they evolved throughout the years, they started getting smaller and smaller. Then they started getting vehicles. Then the vehicles would combine to form giant robots. And then they just got rid of the people inside them and just started doing the giant robots. So Transformers, as we know them, and then eventually Hasbro licensed these robots back from Japan and named them Transformers.
I love it when like major mess ups yield wonderful results.
It's fascinating. It blew my mind when I watched that.
That's really cool. Yeah. No, there are some interesting things there in the G.I. Joe one. And I bet you liked that one because there was a decent amount of Larry Hama in that.
Oh, yeah. I love Larry Hama. He's the only person who ever turned me down for a podcast because he's like, look, if you want to talk about G.I. Joe, I understand, you know, there's a lot of fans out there. I make no money, zero money from anything that Marvel does with G.I. Joe. So I don't want to talk about it. And I'm like,
you
okay.
Respect that.
Yeah. But we're friends on Facebook. So that's all that matters.
Of course. So what's your pick, Patrick?
My pick is slightly sad, but it's also Netflix. It's Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown.
Ah, okay.
And I've been going through the series since Netflix extended it, and they're going to have it on for a little while longer. And I love the show. It's amazing. It's kind of like going to the grocery store hungry, which you should never do. The show will make you hungry. all the time. And I will warn people that it has some graphic moments of chefs doing things to animals to prepare them. And that can be a little shocking when you're not prepared for it. And it's got some stuff that I don't like. They do a whole thing in Spain with bullfighting. But one of my favorite episodes is Sicily. And because Bourdain hates Sicily, and he tried to do a show there once before, and he said it was a disaster. This time he goes, and he's trying to do it on the opposite side of the island, and he is going out with a fisherman slash tour guide who's going to show him where all the best fish can be caught. And they go out in this boat and they're scuba diving or snorkeling. And they're looking, and Bourdain's like, I don't understand. This can't possibly be a good fishing spot because there's so many people here in boats just laughing, having parties. There can't be any fish here. I don't understand, but this guy's telling me this is where the fish are. He goes, and so we go in and we're in the water, and all of a sudden I see a dead fish come floating down from the surface, and then another one, and then another one. He goes, this jackass has another guy in another boat throwing dead fish in the water to try to fool us into thinking these are fresh fish. It was hilarious. He got so pissed off that when he got back to shore, he went off camera and he got stupid drunk. And then he had to film a dinner segment, and his voiceover for the whole thing is like, yeah, so after that, I went off and got drunk, and I'm going to tell you, I don't remember any of this. I don't remember that guy. I don't remember that dish. I don't remember that lady. I don't remember this waiter. I don't remember any of this. This is a complete fog because I was so pissed off.
I've always been interested in that stuff. I'll have to check it out.
It's great. It's great.
Cool. My pick, I've talked about reading Stoicism over the past couple of years. So I just finished one, which was, I was reading the ebook of it, which must have been super long because I feel like I've been reading this for like 2 or 3 months. And that is The Letters from a Stoic, and that's by Seneca. And it's, you know, I've read Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, all this Stoicism, and it's, I get a lot out of it. It is very helpful kind of ways to live your life advice. And it's really had a big impact on how I go about things. So, if you're interested in this stuff, that's the one that I just read recently. And as you know, I kind of go in and highlight as I'm reading it in the, through my Kindle. And then what I do is I send those highlights as an email to myself, which I then open as a Google Doc, print out, and then I'll go through and highlight that with an actual physical highlighter. And then I kind of write down the best bits on index cards. And that I have 36 physical pages of notes from that book. So a lot to unpack there, but it's very good. And I like I said, I got a lot of this, got interested in Stoicism through two people. One guy is Ryan Holiday, who has a daily Stoic book that I really get a lot out of, and Tim Ferriss too, who often talks about Stoicism. And I believe Seneca is one of the big ones that he talks about. So,
I mean, I read every single one of Tim Ferriss's books. They are unbelievable.
Yeah, I was going to ask that because I kind of feel like at some point I saw you talk a little bit about Tim Ferriss on Twitter. So I didn't know if you've read any of this stuff. So.
No, like we leave his books around the house. Like that's what we, you know, you sit down to breakfast, read a book, in the bathroom, read a book. Yeah, got 5 minutes, read a book. Like, yeah, very influential on our family.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I've talked about it a billion times, but I still do that slow carb diet that he wrote about in 4-Hour Body. I've been doing that for like 5 years. I lost 30 pounds and I've been that weight since then, and I still follow it. And his most recent ones have been very good too. It was A Tribe of Mentors, and what's the other recent one? Tools of Titans. Both of those are essential. Well, Tools of Titans especially is basically his podcast in written form.
Yeah.
But so much more useful than I thought, because I bought that and I'm like, well, I listen to a lot of these podcasts, so I know. But to have it in written form where you can go through and you can highlight it, write down notes, really good stuff. Yep. So Yeah, so check out that stuff. All right, so Kill the Farm Boy.
Kill the Farm Boy.
So obviously, you co-wrote this with Kevin. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind sharing, how did the two of you meet?
Well, you got to go way on back. So I wrote my first book in 2009, got an agent in 2010, sold a book in 2011. That book came out in 2012 and was Wicked as They Come, which is like a steampunk, dark fantasy vampire romance. But, you know, I got this email from my agent that was like, oh, you've had an invitation into an anthology. It was my first anthology invitation, and it was going to be printed by Simon & Schuster, and it was carnypunk. And they were like, you're one of the few people in the world actually writing, you know, carnypunk already, so you're a good fit. So I wrote my story. It was called The Three Lives of Lydia. I was so proud of it. It was in this book. And I later got an invitation from Kevin to come out to a carnypunk signing in Houston. And so I get out there and we have a couple drinks and he comes around to like, I was kind of foisted on him. He had no idea who I was. Simon & Schuster, when they were printing it, were like, oh, well, you know, we'll print this, we'll pay you, but we get three slots for our authors. And so I just kind of got shoved in there as I'm like, oh, what is this crap? and he ended up really liking the story and we really, really got along and just became good friends. We also had kind of an entree because Sherry Priest introduced us at Phoenix Comic Con. So yeah, we just, that's how we met, was I got foisted into his carnypunk anthology and was not terrible. And then Sherry vouched for me and we got to be friends. But yeah, Kevin is one of the best people I've ever met on life. He is a pure good soul.
Agreed.
And super fun to write with and hang out with and drink with.
So when did the idea for, how did the idea for Kill the Farm Boy get hatched then? Did you pitch it to him? Did he pitch to you? Did it hit you as a lightning bolt when you guys were together one time? How did the ball get rolling on this book?
Sure. We were in Dallas for a book signing with Charlene Harris and Rachel Kane and our buddy Jay Wells. We were staying at Jay's house. And on the way back, we were at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport at 10 o'clock in the morning. And like, you know, that's that weird time for breakfast where it's like, you don't want a janky breakfast, but the nice, decent airplane lunch places hadn't opened yet. And so we ended up at this barbecue place that was pretty subpar. And we were just kind of sitting there being like, well, I'm wasting calories on this that kind of tastes like a McRib. And he was like, hey, I've got this idea for an anthology. Be called Kill the Farm Boy. And we'd invite all of our friends and everybody would write about a story about a different trope in fantasy that we're kind of sick of. And so, you know, he named like the chosen one was the one he was going to do with Kill the Farm Boy. We talked about the chainmail bikini, about, you know, the bard that was terrible, but just different ways of kind of skewering these tropes that many of them seemed based in, you know, patriarchy or misogyny, like the chosen one, always a young white farm boy, you know, who is told he's going to be great and then he becomes great. And, you know, the chainmail bikini is where you have like the big, beautiful woman who obviously can't wear decent armor. She's wearing a bikini made of chainmail. And so we're like, oh, that's great. But, you know, a couple months in, we got around to the point where I was like, man, this is a lot of work. It's hurting cats. We're reaching out to people. And, you know, we realized, you know, we need to have a good mix of, you know, we wanted it to be a diverse anthology, but we didn't want it, you know, there's all these different things to consider that when you're maybe a writer and not an organizer, you start going, this isn't fun anymore. And so I was like, hey, what if we just wrote it, you and me, and traded chapters back and forth, and then we could write this, have it under our own control, and each only write half a book, which was kind of like just zany enough to work. So we started outlining it and wrote the first couple of chapters. And it was just so much fun because, you know, you get used to, Kevin and I at the time were both in these big series. He was in like book 11 or 12 of his Iron Druid. I was at that time finishing up the Blood series and heading into the Wake of Vulture series. You know, serious things, serious people. And it was so much fun just to write this goofy, weird thing where you can make fun of elf boners and kill the farm boy and just play with kind of Terry Pratchett, Discworld, princess bride kind of tropes. And it was just a delight. Like you'd be slogging through your edits, then it would be your turn to write this chapter and you would just have a drink and giggle for 2 hours. And then, you know, it was great. It's just fun.
Now, is that how you guys structured it after you did the outline? Did you alternate chapters? Is that how you did it?
Pretty much. Well, we would do the outline and kind of fill it in together where we had ideas. There would be like, you know, little holes in it, and then we'd add more and add more. And towards the end, like the last five chapters or so, were, you know, kind of like important things happen, important thing happens, climax, epilogue, ending, because we still weren't 100% sure. And then we would have certain things that we would be kind of attached to where it would be like, okay, well, you know, I just wrote chapter 9 and then you write chapter 10, but I really want to do 11 and 12. Is that okay? Oh, sure. I really wanted to do 13 and 14, but it was all very, there's no, literally no negativity. It's all, oh, that sounds great, buddy. Yeah, I can do that. Sure. Whatever you want. That sounds great. I'll do it. It's just all so positive. So yeah, it's very rare that we both wanted to write the same chapter or that we both didn't want to write the same chapter or that we disagreed with something in the outline. And when we did, you know, it was all just, oh, that's okay. It's not a big deal to me. Do whatever you want.
Now, did you tend to focus on certain characters when you wrote your chapters, or it didn't matter in terms of whose characters you were writing?
There isn't really a lot of ownership in these characters. We kind of came up with all of them together and they developed them together. It's not like one of us made a fully formed character and was like, this is mine. It was more, you know, one of us would start with it, the other person would start writing, and then we'd add to it and deepen it. And, you know, maybe an edit's come back and give someone like a voice affectation or add in a strange fear or something. But it's all very, the reason that our writing partnership works is that we're not precious about any of this. There's no ego in it. There's no, you know, showing somebody up or this is my character. It's just all so giving and generous. And we're so excited about what the other person is doing that we haven't encountered any kind of squabbles yet, because we've both managed to keep, you know, our clutchy hands out of holding on to anything like it's personal.
What you mentioned there reminded me. I was just watching this interview series, and I'm gonna have to look it up later to remember what the name of it. It's this series on Netflix that it's like a black and white interview show, and there's some big name guests like Robert Downey Jr. and all sorts of people on it. And I watched some of an episode with John Bryan, who is a Brion is how his last name is spelled. He's in a bunch of bands that I really liked, but he's had a bigger career as a film composer. So he's done a lot of the Paul Thomas Anderson movies and lots of other stuff too. They were talking about his music process and, you know, did he like making his singer-songwriter albums more? Did he like producing? Because he's done a lot of production too. He's done produced a Kanye West album, and he does all these different things, and he does film composing and all these really different musical things. And they asked him about it and about, you know, which do you like best and, you know, which works. And what he said was, he's like, well, in some things I'm, you know, kind of the ruler, like I have the last say, and it's, you know, I have total control over it. And then in other things, I'm there just to help somebody sort of see their vision through. And then in other things, it's more of a collaboration back and forth. And what he said, which I thought was really interesting from a creative point of view, is he thinks that the people who are the happiest have different times, have different situations where they have a different role, where sometimes their role is like, I am controlling everything here. This is my vision completely. Sometimes it's collaborative. Sometimes you're there to just kind of make someone else look better. So is this kind of a thing where it's a totally different thing for you, and then therefore it's a breath of fresh air from your normal writing process?
Well, I mean, it's just different. I mean, you could say I have my own books that I write where I am the god of this world. I am the soul, you know, end all be all. If I don't like something an editor wants, or if I get a copy edit, I can stead it. And I have these places where I get to be God. And then I've also done a lot of work in IP in a shared world. So, you know, Star Wars, Adventure Time, Labyrinth, X-Files, Shadow Man, all of these things where I go in knowing I'm writing in someone else's world and that they are the ultimate kind of God. Anything I do can get smacked down for any reason or no reason. And so I think that process has stripped me of that bit of ego of, this is my baby, this is my thing that I made up. So I can go into a situation going, none of this is my baby, and all of this is fine. And also knowing, because Kevin and I are good friends, that if there is something that matters to me, I can go to him and, you know, be like, hey, homie, I kind of wanted to do this because this, I know you had some problems. How can we move forward? You know, where it's not a, I'm going to take my toys and go home. It's a, hey, let's fix this toy together. So yeah, I don't know if this would be more challenging for someone who hadn't done so much writing in IP and learned, you know, that situation of you are not God, so stop even trying. But it's all very collaborative to the point where we get to, after we've, so it's like, one of us will write a chapter and send it to the other person. And then the second person will edit their chapter and then send it back. And then you'll edit. And then, you know, so it's like we have this back and forth of, you know, edit, write, send it over, edit, write, send it over, edit, write, where by the time we've gone through the books, we've written it and we've done two or three different rounds of edits, then polishing the copy edits, I don't even remember what chapters I wrote. Because we both had so much of a hand in every part of it.
I was actually going to ask if you did that where you edited each other's work, because I don't know why, but Patrick's going to giggle when I say this, because I say this every time we have co-authors. I'm fascinated by the co-authoring process. I really am, because writing always, and I'm not a writer, it always seems like such a solitary thing that when people can write together, it's always amazing to me. And I know, I'm probably going to mess up their name, but Clay and Susan Griffin,
yeah.
I always mess up their name. They sort of, now they're a married couple, I believe, but their writing process, I think, is kind of similar to the way that you're describing it with Kevin, where they edit each other. And by the end, it does have a very consistent voice where it's hard to tell who wrote what part. So I thank you for describing that, because it starts to make more sense. Because I would imagine if it was just like one person wrote one chapter, one person wrote the next, it could feel disjointed.
Yeah, I've heard several different like horror and happy stories about co-writing, and you know, everybody does it differently. Ours works for us, but I feel like the caveat for that is, number one, we're really good friends. Like, I have stayed at Kevin's home and held his pug, and we've had like tearful conversations about our childhood. Like, we're solid friends. And number two, we both really admire and uplift each other's writing and creativity. In very giving-ish and selfish, super proud of each other. We trust each other's writing and craft and have great admiration for each other. And I feel like I don't think we could have the writing partnership we do if we didn't have those two things as the basis for the backgrounds that we come to bringing this together, where there's just complete trust of skill and, you know, just of emotional feeling. Like, we both know where the other one is coming from.
I love hearing that, because I think any creative process, especially something that's kind of competitive, like just trying to get people to read your work, I think oftentimes you will have, you know, I think it's hard for people sometimes to get to that point where you're just so kind of admiring of each other's work rather than competitive. So that's great to hear. Patrick, I feel like I'm hogging the interview. Do you have a question?
No, it's just good. I think it boils down to friendship and respect. You know, they are very good friends, and they respect each other, and they respect their what each brings to the table and their skills. And if you don't have that, any sort of collaboration is going to be doomed.
Mm. Yeah. Now, you brought up writing an IP, and before the show started, we talked a little bit about some of your Star Wars stuff, and I loved the Phasma novel that you wrote. I really think that fleshed that character out so well. And I know you'd written The Perfect Weapon as well. How did you come about getting those gigs writing that stuff?
You know, I feel like so much of writing is a trail that it's like a fire slug. You blaze a trail and you burn it behind you, so people can't necessarily follow you there. Which I feel about comics too. Like, I can tell you how to get an agent and get published, but I can't tell you how to write IP or comics, although I will try on Twitter frequently. So for Star Wars, the first secret weapon I have is that my first book series, the Blood series, which started with Wicked As They Come, was bought at auction. And the house that won the auction was Simon & Schuster's Pocket Division, and the editor at the time was Jennifer Heddle, which she is now one of the main editors at Lucasfilm for Star Wars books. So that's like this secret feather in my cap, is that one of the very main directional editors over there already loved my work enough to buy my first series at a pretty good price. So I have that. Then I have the fact that I'm very good friends with Chuck Wendig, Kevin Hearn, Ty and Daniel, who are James S.A. Corey. I had several friends who were Star Wars writers who had already put my name in before I had been like, hey, buddy, if you ever get a chance to tell them, they're like, oh, yeah, I already told them you'd be great at it. I had my agent send over a packet of my books to some Del Rey editors. I tweeted about it. And most importantly, I was at Walmart and I saw a cupcake with a Darth Vader ring in it. And so I bought it to do some black magic. And I put it in the freezer and was like, I'm going to eat this cupcake when I get to write for Star Wars. And so every day I'd look at the cupcake and be like, come on, Satan. And after a week, I was like, why is this magic not working? And after 2 weeks, I was like, this is garbage. And after 3 weeks, I just ate it like Cookie Monster. I was like, screw you, magic. And then the next week I got my email about The Perfect Weapon. The perfect weapon. So I definitely think that the cupcake black magic had something to do with that.
That's awesome.
But, you know, again, like this is like three or four different vectors, you know, that most people can't take advantage of. And I also like it's a good fit for me. Like, I'm a huge lifetime Star Wars fan, but if you look at my body of work, kind of my bailiwick is dangerous women and intricate world building. So, you know, these are the things I've gotten to write for Star Wars have fit in very well with that.
So can I tell my takeaway from that entire story?
Eat cupcakes?
Well, yes, obviously. But no, it's be a good writer who builds great worlds and knows what you're doing and have good interactions with people and be consistent and meet your deadlines and all that kind of good stuff. Just be a good writer.
Yeah.
And opportunities can come your way. That's not necessarily they're going to come your way, but you will get good opportunities.
Well, you won't get opportunities unless you have 5 to 10 years of a solid writing career under you that demonstrates speed, diligence, being easy to work with, working well within constraints, not being precious about things, not being a diva. Like this is not a thing that they're like, who here loves Star Wars the most? Let's give them a call. It's a combination of like, who do we know can do this? Because writing for IP and especially something Star Wars that demands it be very fast and very accurate, it's a different skill set. You can't take 4 years to write a Star Wars book.
And I read some stuff that they were looking for very specific people for essentially the rebooted book universe, right? They wanted people with certain skills.
Well,
and you were on that list.
They definitely, I feel, were trying to. I mean, it's if you look at the EU, it's mostly old white dudes, and you know, you can tell that they want to. I'm not saying not choose an old white dude, but open up the opportunity to more than just that demographic, which I think they're doing a great job of.
Absolutely. That's
another benefit of writing Star Wars. Well, is like, I love hanging out with Star Wars writers. They are so much fun. Like, we get together at cons, like a group of friends, and just hang out. Nice people, fun people.
What I take away from what Delilah just said is that all those authors that she mentioned, you know what they have in common, Patrick?
Hmm.
They've been on this show.
They've been on the show, yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's, yeah, there you go.
The truth
that's
is
how
out.
You get a Star Wars
Your movie. Email list is yes, about to fill up.
Well, I should also mention that a few weeks ago it was announced that our good friend Mer Lafferty is going to be doing the Solo novelization. So we're
so
very
happy.
Excited for her. Same thing, you know, she's how long has she been out there proving that she can write great books, build great worlds, all that.
Yeah, man, you got to hustle.
Yeah, no, it's you know, it reminds me of I'm going to say it wrong, but Neil Gaiman has a bit of advice about that too, of, you know, being, you know, so you have to sort of satisfy 3 out of these 4 things, like of being a good writer, meeting your deadlines, being a good person who people can get along with, and a couple other things. And it's basically like, you have to be good at least 2 of those, and they'll kind of let you slide a little bit on 1 of them. But if you're bad at 2 of them, then you're not going to get any work. Like you can, it's like, he sort of was saying like, you can be a little late on your deadlines if you're awesome and a cool person, or it's like, you can maybe not be the coolest person in the world if you hit your deadlines and are all, you know, so I think it's all of those things. And hey, if you could do them all, so much the better. So,
yeah.
I don't want to Star Wars. It's really tricky stuff to talk about. Cause now I was going to ask something that I don't want to get you into trouble with, but so what's not for Star Wars, but what else is coming up for you? Cause you have the book with Kevin, that's going to be out on the 17th.
Kill the Farm Boys, July 17th. That's the first in a 3-book series. We've got No Country for Old Gnomes and The Princess Beard, you know, on deck for you.
Hmm. And then what about some of your own like stuff that's just under your name? Do you have anything coming up with that you can mention, or is it still too early for that stuff?
Sure. This October 16th is the launch of Treason of Hawks, which is the 4th and last book in my Shadow series. It starts with Wake of Vultures, which is written under the pen name Lila Bowen, but it's me, which I bill it as Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Lonesome Dove, Weird West with Monsters.
Nice.
And then I've also got, I'm under contract to adapt The Dragon Riders of Pern, Dragonflight, to comics.
Oh, wow.
We don't have a date for that, but it's in the works and the papers are signed, so I would assume it's going to happen.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Was that a series that meant a lot to you?
I came to it later than maybe some people did, but loved it immediately. I love dragon stuff. I love Temeraire. It was a good match. I really am getting into kind of adapting things. I guess it's another skill set, moving kind of fluidly between novels and comics and being able to break those things down and still get, you know, because comics are condensed and they're a lot different from novels. So that's a thing I'm getting around to. We do have a comics project that will be announced on July 3rd that I can't say anything else about, but a new something I've been working on. Oh, and Rick and Morty. I wrote a Rick and Morty issue. I wrote Pickle Rick.
What?
That's awesome.
For the series of one-shots, you know, it started with the Vindicators. Then they've got, I think, Sleepy Gary and Krabopulous Michael coming out. And then mine will be the fourth one, Pickle Rick.
Fantastic. That's great. That's really awesome.
The Rickmobile is coming to Colorado Springs. I just wanted to throw that
out. Oh, nice. I've never seen it.
It's supposed to be pretty awesome.
And you mentioned some cons. Do you have any convention appearances coming up that people can check you out at?
Yes. I love conventions. It's basically my sanity base because I'm a stay-at-home mom, and especially in the summer. Sadly, I've had to pull out of Salt Lake, which I'm very sad about. But in July, Kevin Kern and I will be launching Killed Farm Boy at the Poison Pen in Scottsdale. And then we have several tour stops that have kind of San Diego Comic-Con sandwiched in the middle, where we will be together and signing books on that. The 17th will be at Poison Pen in Scottsdale. Then San Diego Comic-Con is the 19th through the 22nd of July. Then we're doing a book signing at Anderson's Bookshop in Naperville, Illinois on the 23rd. At Malaprops Bookstore in Asheville, North Carolina on the 24th. At my good old favorite Foxtail Bookshop in Woodstock, Georgia on the 25th. And there might be one more tour date announced, but we don't know yet. And all that is on my website at whimsydark.com/events.
Awesome. Very good. Very good. For us, once again, if you dig the show, dig interviews with people like Delilah here, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you want to leave our listeners with before we go?
Not that I can think of. I'm excited to read this book.
Mm. Yay!
Yes.
Prepare for elf boners.
I know. These are... Boy, if I had a nickel every time that was said. Woof.
Right? Nike almost put that through their thing, but we kept it.
Nice. All right, Delilah, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And everybody else, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye!
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.